the first week was going to be normal Fermi liquids, and the second week was going to be superconductivity, and that's approximately true. However, the first week, you may recall, was a little bit abbreviated, be careful, because of Family Day. And so I thought that I wanted to do a little bit more about the normal state, particularly because there's a lot of ideas that are relevant to the superconductivity. So tomorrow, hopefully, if I can finish this tomorrow, we'll start on superconductivity. So what I wanted to discuss is so-called Landau's Fermi liquid theory. Which is, if you like, indicated by the Hartree-Fock theory that we did at the end of last week. In other words, it sort of starts from there and then just generalizes, okay, and not particularly as the result of a calculation, but more in the form of arguments. Okay, so basically, what Landau postulated that if you imagine that the interactions are in a otherwise non-interacting Fermi gas are turned on adiabatically. Okay, so you understand the problem of the non-interacting Fermi gas. In fact, I think after last week, you understand the problem of an interacting Fermi gas that can be treated accurately within Hartree-Fock or mean field theory. You can sort of see what's happening. But imagine that you just ask the question, what happens if you start off and turn the interactions up? How does the system behave? Okay, so. Well, you can call it adiabatically or slowly or continuously. So if you do that, there's sort of two possibilities. One is that the system. Well, one possibility is that all hell breaks loose and it's anybody's guess what you get, okay? And the other possibility is that things change slowly and continuously, and so the system continues to resemble where it started from. It evolves continuously from where it started. The question you have to ask then is, okay, so say that happens, what's going to change? And what's going to stay the same? Okay, so that's sort of the question that Landau was addressing. So imagine that this is the case. Then I mean, I would qualify this by saying, if nothing else happens, then. The fermions continue to be described by integers and an energy functional that looks like this. Let's write it like this. E, which is depends on the set of n alpha of k. That's equal to E naught of n0, alpha of k, plus so n, in this thing here, you say n alpha of k is equal to n naught alpha of k plus delta n alpha of k. Okay, so we make the following observations. So if the delta n's are all zero, there's some ground state energy. If you imagine following this prescription, turning on the interactions continuously, then this ground state energy will evolve continuously, and the n naughts will evolve in some continuous way. And we said how you calculate those for in Hartree-Fock. Basically, you do it in a self-consistent way so that, yeah.
And alphas being zero and one being integers, how can you have a continuous change?
Like, how do you mean by that? Like, how do you get
because
this is the okay. So this is an F-pattern system, right? NE is the order of 10 to the 23rd. Okay? And the number of states that you have is given by the interval per state is some volume. It's some volume in k states. It goes like one over the linear dimension of the sample. Okay, so you have densely spaced states and tons of them. So all these zeros and ones here are like quasi-continuous changes in this. Okay. I mean, the reason why you say 0 and 1 is because of Fermi statistics. The state is either occupied or empty. Okay. So it all. Yeah.
No, you can finish.
Well, is that. I just thought you were going to continue.
No.
Oh, you're going to change the subject? Okay. So, is that.
So when you say you're doing a continuous change, you mean you're changing.
Okay, wait. Here I was talking about continuously turning the interaction up from zero.
Yep.
In a way that continuously perturbs the ground state energy and the excitation, or the excitation. And for that matter, the interaction. But still is described by this thing that just says that for some ground state where things are occupied up to a certain energy or a certain Fermi surface, and that the otherwise the excitations involve either taking an electron out of an occupied state or putting an electron into a unoccupied state. That's what this says. That's the essence, if you like, of the normal Fermi record.
I'm not really related to that, but
okay.
Yeah, I don't quite get the your equation in terms of like the k dependence and alpha of your like the first term
This one here?
Yeah, like, I mean, his cane, his alpha.
This is the energy of a, basically, of a filled Fermi.
So it's just a non-interacting.
Yeah. This is the ground state. This is the ground state energy. Okay. So basically, what it is, it corresponds to no excitations. Okay. So I mean, you could just compress that.
Yeah.
It is the ground state energy, whatever that is. The system. That's it. And then this is what happens if you create excitations of a particular type that involve removing the electron or removing it, having a state be unoccupied below the Fermi surface and occupied above. So that's the idea. Chris.
No.
Okay. So, and then the point is, as before, I mean, as in Hartree Fock in general, this thing is positive because if this is negative, then this thing would be minus one, in other words, removing an occupation, and then it's positive. So basically, the excitation from the ground state, if you like, of the stable system are positive energy. And then this is sort of the residual interaction that's left between these quasi-particles that define the excitation section of the system.
And does mu also change? Is mu supposed to also change?
Well, mu is something you can control externally. It depends whether or not.
Yeah. So it is, we're holding you constant? So we can't get to the 15 and zero for no times.
And mu controls the density of electrons, and so it sort of depends on precisely what you're calculating. It's a chemical constant. Okay, if you hold mu's constant, say you hold mu, it sort of depends on whether you want to keep the number of density of electrons constant or the chemical potential constant. I mean, imagine that you physically did this. You have a bunch of electrons or fermions that are in equilibrium with some kind of bath, and then you turn on some, say, repulsive interaction between them. Well, there's going to be fewer of them. They're going to go running out into the bath. Okay. So you have your choice as to whether you're going to let that happen or you're going to adjust the chemical potential so the density stays the same. So it sort of depends on what you're talking about. Okay. But the idea is that whatever Q is, then, and this comes up in the Hartree Fock calculations, where you absorb something into the chemical potential through these constant terms.
Is it true that we're developing E minus mu equals E naught minus mu naught?
This is the. You can do it. So you're saying it's what thermodynamic? This is just energy if you want. That's something that is like the potential function for a system that constantly could subtract the length from that. And then, I mean, that's cool. Okay, so now there's a whole literature that goes along with this where people say, okay, well, if you have a system with spin-independent interactions, what can the form of F be? How can it depend on the spin indices? These Fs here will affect transport properties like thermal conductivity and various transport coefficients. This E here is contains the self-consistent band structure, if you like, of the interacting system. So it determines the, both this and actually this determine like things like the heat capacity and the susceptibility. And also these F functions, you can sort of distill them down into a small number of parameters that you can use to describe particular systems. So you can come up with experimental values for these. I don't really want to talk about any of that. Okay, there's many articles and books written on that. I just want to say that the something about the fermionic what are the excitation? What does the spectrum of excitations look like? That's really one thing that I'd like to emphasize. So if you have something here called the Fermi sphere, say, then all these states inside are occupied and the states outside are empty. And so you can excite the system in a variety of ways. You can create a hole here and put an electron outside here. And because there are states, and these arguments I'm going to make apply equally well if the interactions are zero, or if you turn them up continuously, as long as you're in this regime. Okay, so the fermionic spectrum applies to the system, which is the Fermi liquid. Okay, the simple fact that you can excite the system by taking an occupied an electron from an occupied state inside the Fermi sphere or quasi particle state to one, and removing this one and adding this one, this corresponds to an excitation where the energy can be made arbitrarily small and the change in momentum of the system, or if you like, the momentum associated with the excitation can be made arbitrarily small. Okay, so there are excitations of this system which have negligible momentum and negligible energy, and actually having arbitrarily low energy excitations for a system is one very important property. It basically means that it's easy to excite the system. Okay. On the other hand, you can equally well have an excitation of the system where you remove this guy there and you you put something up here, which is, say, k minus 2 kF in that direction. Okay. So if you remove an electron or a fermion from just below the Fermi energy, which is from an occupied state, and put it into a state which is just above the Fermi energy or outside the Fermi sphere, but which differs in momentum by minus 2 kF, then that corresponds to an excitation of the system which carries a large momentum and costs negligible energy. And you can see from this picture that you can get anything in between. So if you were to ask, what are the possible excitations, omega as a function of Q, say, in a one-dimensional type picture, what are the possible excitations of this normal Fermi liquid? They lie the relation of possible energy-momentum pairs of the excitations. If this is 2kF, lie within this range. Okay? Yeah.
The electrons are supposed to be in orbital. So
are supposed to be?
Electrons are supposed to be in orbitals around the atom, right?
Well, okay, so we're talking about electrons that are in states that are delocal, that are labeled by wave vectors, these block states.
So why are you using this question, this argument here? Because I might as well assume that the electrons are in orbital, so the electron form of them can be equivalent to an electron just besides this.
Sorry, this is the k space here. Kx, ky, kx, okay? And this is for a weakly interacting system, this is a surface of constant energy that corresponds to Kelvin potential. And so
at any point, they put
every point in here corresponds to a
state of constant energy around the sphere.
But they have a different momentum. Every point corresponds to a different wavelength. Okay? So the question is that you can excite the system. Well, so how do you excite a system? You apply some kind of external field that couples the electrons, some potential. It can be a function of time or frequency, if you like, Fourier transform. It can be a function of space, it can be which if you Fourier transform will be a function of wave vector. Okay, so you apply some perturbation to the system. Which has a frequency, time dependence, and a wave vector. And the question is what kind of excitations, you know, does that couple to? Okay? So you can create excitations at any place in this region. Okay, so that if you apply a perturbation, you can spatially and time varying perturbation, you can excite, you can create these excitations at frequencies and wave vectors anywhere in here. Yeah, sorry.
The reason why we don't go below k minus 2kF is that because of the periodicity in the reciprocal space?
These states are all occupied. So you can remove electrons from here, but you can't add them because these states are all occupied. So you can add an electron, you can take a fermion that it's occupying the state inside and move it to a state outside. But you can't move it to another state inside because that state's already occupied.
So the point k minus 2kF, is that outside?
Yeah, I think so.
Further in the other direction?
So this is k minus 2kF.
So could we go further in this direction?
You can go further, yeah. And that will create an excitation with a higher energy and a higher momentum. So up here, say.
Okay.
This is just the minimum you can do. You can create an excitation with zero energy and momentum 2kF. If you go, you take a fermion from here and move it across, all the way across. That's about as far as you can go and stay at zero energy excitation. That's the point. These all have the same energy going on here. So that's the question you're addressing. How can you perturb this system? Okay? As a function of the momentum that you add or subtract and the energy that you add or subtract.
Why are we plotting versus omega rather than versus energy?
That's energy. That's the energy of the excitation.
Okay.
Sorry. Just omega. The energy of the excitation.
Okay.
So that's what you mean. Okay, so this picture that I've drawn can be for a non-interacting system, which is the language in which I've been describing it. As you turn on the interactions, it becomes an interacting system. These lines, these slopes might change. If you have to ask what you mean by, well, nothing much is going to change except the boundaries of this. However, there is one other thing that can happen. So this is called a particle hole continuum. Okay. There is one other thing that can happen if you turn on the interactions. In particular, if you turn on a long-range interaction like the Coulomb interaction, you can get additional possible excitations, which are called collective modes. And in the case particularly important for electrons is the so-called plasma mode, if this is omega t. And this, for charged systems, this will be the plasmon. And there is a sharp, so for an interacting system with the Coulomb interaction, there is a well-defined mode which corresponds to what plasma oscillations, what plasma oscillations look like if you imagine plotting charge density now, this is the density of the ions. So the ions have some density in a solid, and it's relatively rigid. Okay? And then if you oscillate the electron density, it's the average electron density is equal to the average ion density, charge density of the ions. So if you create an oscillation in the electron density, so then this would be minus minus, this would be plus plus because you have a deficit, and so forth. So this would be a plasmon of wave vector. This is plotted versus x. Say this is lambda. So this is an oscillation of the electron density, which is in the background of uniform ion density. This particular Q vector will have a frequency, say here, this is Q. That's that Q, would have a frequency up here. Okay? So the point is that if you work out the excitations of the interacting system in the presence of Coulomb interactions, what you'll find is you'll get this particle hole continuum. It's always there as long as the thing is a Fermi liquid. But you can also get this collective mode. It will start off at something called the plasma frequency that depends on the plasma frequency squared, depends on the density of electrons. We'll come back to that later. It'll be a nice sharp mode. As soon as it starts to overlap the particle hole continuum, it will become a heavily overdamped mode because the plasmon can decay into multiple particle hole pairs. This is called Landau damping. It's just the damping due to the fact that it can decay into particle hole pairs. It sort of disappears as a mode. Okay, so this is, yeah.
These plasmons are some type of boson?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
There's some kind of boson. There are bound particle hole pairs put together cleverly to conform to the Coulomb interaction. If you like, when you do the calculation, you've got these modes and you split off
this collective mode. It's a little bit like solving a bound state problem. It splits off and is a sharp propagating mode. As long as its wave vector isn't too large, if it's in here, it's broadened down. Okay? So I put this in here because this is another feature that you'll find in excitation spectra of charged fermionic systems. So you won't find this in helium 3, which is another Fermi liquid. But it's a Fermi liquid of neutral fermions. And then just to sort of round out the picture, what would you expect for bosons, for the excitation spectrum of bosons? Okay? So basically, So let's call this E versus Q of bosons. In the non-interacting Bose system that's, say, Bose condensed, your excitations will just be free particle-like. And then for an interacting system, and there's different ways of showing this, but for the interacting system, you will get a spectrum that looks like this. Okay? If the bosons are weakly interacting, basically you get a linear spectrum that looks like a phonon spectrum, longitudinal phonons. Okay. There's a beautiful paper from the 50s by Feynman where he showed that even in a strongly interacting bosonic system like liquid helium 4, you still get this, but you also get, actually, this thing maybe dips down a little bit more, a minimum in the energy versus wave vector. It's called the roton. Okay. But the point is that for the bosonic spectrum, or these collective modes, you have sharp energy versus wave vector relations. Whereas for the fermionic system, you have this continuous region of particle hole excitations. Okay. So now, this argument that if you turn on the interactions continuously, then the system behaves like a, still continues to behave like a fermionic system. There was one other thing I wanted to say. I see, I put that off till later. Oh, I see, okay. It works until it doesn't. Okay, Chris.
Typically speaking, why is it that bosons should give us that you can a smaller range of correspondences between energy and wave vector?
You mean why are they sharp? Why are these excitations sharp? What can I say? There's this enormous difference between having your ground state be a filled Fermi sea and having your ground state be a Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the Fermi, the exclusion principle just changes everything. Okay, and that's why you have particle hole pairs as your excitations. Okay. I mean, you might ask, why do you have sharp things? But we're not, yeah, I mean, okay, so we won't do bosons. But so what I said is, I mean, it works until it doesn't. And the counterexample that Landau gives, which you should just keep in the back of your head, is say that you have a gas of deuterium atoms. Well, they're going to want to form molecules. The molecules are bosons. You're going to have a bose. It's totally different. Okay? So we'll come back to that at some point. But as long as you can turn on the interactions and everything evolves continuously, then the quasiparticles They carry charge E. Momentum H bar K. Spin S, spin half, actually. And the energy is given, if you like, by an effective mass or some band structure. In the simplest theories, the interactions give you an effective mass, which is different from your bare mass. Okay, so I'd like to say a few more things about these quasiparticles. There's a lifetime that results from the residual interactions. The fact that there's, you know, the term that I just erased here that's quadratic in the fluctuation says that these are interacting, the quasiparticles are interacting. So if you have a quasiparticle whose energy is either just below or just above the Fermi energy, very close to the Fermi energy, so that it differs from the Fermi energy by an amount epsilon, it has a lifetime that goes like the square of this energy difference. And you can generalize that to finite temperature to show that its energy lifetime goes like the square of the temperature. So this goes away as T goes to zero, you're left with this. If you're at finite temperature, then this might dominate over this for a given quasiparticle. So this epsilon might be this, say. Epsilon. Well, of course, this is in K space, so the difference in energy between this particle and that. So the point is that the lifetime of this quasiparticle with wave vector k and excitation energy epsilon of k, in other words, distance from the Fermi energy epsilon, you can calculate for weak interactions just via a golden rule type of calculation. And the golden rule calculation would say that this is something like 2 pi over h bar, sum over q and q. Maybe I should just draw a picture here. This guy's coming along with wave vector k. Some other quasiparticle it interacts with has wave vector q. It transfers momentum q. This guy goes off with q plus q, and this guy goes off with k minus q. That's an interaction process where two quasiparticles. So basically, this quasiparticle here can scatter off of some quasiparticle and scatter this into another state, and it scatters into another state. Yeah, I was gonna write it. Sorry, I just drew the picture. So
no, but I mean not for this case.
For transitions, just for transitions between this state and this state. But then I'm going to sum over all the quasiparticles that might be around, and then all the final states that you can get to. So this would be something like this. Sorry, k minus q, q plus q. energy has to be conserved. And then, for this transition rate, the state Q has to be occupied. Sorry, this is the mess. Let's take this out. So basically, what this says is there's some matrix element squared due to the interactions that scatters you between these states. The energy has to be conserved. This state has to be occupied initially for the particle to scatter off of it, and these two states have to be empty initially. So here's your particle in state K with energy epsilon measured with respect to the Fermi energy. It's going to excite a particle in state Q. It's going to go to K minus Q. And this guy is going to go to Q plus Q. Now, the point to this argument is the following. If this guy has energy epsilon with respect to the Fermi energy, it can only excite electrons or quasi-particles from occupied states which are within epsilon of the Fermi energy. For things that are down here, way inside, far below the Fermi energy, it can't do anything to. Okay? So this guy here can excite this particle outside, and it can, say, go to some lower energy, like that, say. Okay? So buried in this formula is the fact that this guy has to be between epsilon of the Fermi energy. And then there's two sums, sum over Q, little q and big Q. The final states also have to be within epsilon of the Fermi energy. And so putting that together gives you your epsilon squared. And when you do the same calculation, the same kind of calculation, but do it at finite temperature, where these n's turn into Fermi distribution functions, you have the same thing, that there has to be, you have to excite something within kT of the Fermi energy into a state which is within kT of the Fermi energy. You get the T squared. You can work that out. Okay. So basically what this tells you is that the quasi-particle lifetimes well, let's put it this way. The quasi-particle energies they become sharp as you approach the Fermi energy. And they become sharp in the following sense, that epsilon, if you're epsilon from the Fermi energy, then the width, the energy width, is of order epsilon squared. So if you like, the uncertainty in the energy of the particle, of the quasi-particle, becomes arbitrarily less than the energy, excitation energy itself, as epsilon goes to zero, because its energy is epsilon and its width is epsilon squared. Okay? So basically, that's sort of a important feature of these quasi-particles, that when you're looking at the properties of a Fermi liquid, you're interested in low energies, because basically the temperature that you're operating at is very small compared to the Fermi energy. Okay, the Fermi energy is electron volts, which is 10 to the fourth of degrees Kelvin, and you're looking at things at 10 to the 2 or 10 to the or 10 or 1 or a fraction of a Kelvin. Okay, so you're really only interested in the properties of the excitations in quasi-particles right around the Fermi energy. And the point is that those energies become well-defined at EF. They become very sharp. Okay. So that's that. And then, I wanted to say something briefly about transport. And I'm only going to talk about the conductivity. And in fact, I'm only going to talk about the response to a uniform field. Ikosa? Okay, exactly that. As you go away from the Fermi energy, they have a finite lifetime because of interactions. Okay? But as you go to the Fermi surface, they become sharp. Yeah, if you say, at t equals zero, at even at t equals zero, the fact that, so the question is what happens if you add an electron to your system, or add a quasi-particle to your system above the Fermi energy? How well defined is its energy? Okay, it's not a question of what's sitting there. But if you add one, and it's at some energy epsilon with respect to the Fermi energy, just by adding an electron into that quasi-particle state, then how well defined is its energy? It interacts with everything else and has a width, but not as its energy goes to zero. Yeah. Just the
energy versus wave vector. I mean, if you have a complicated band structure, it isn't that well defined, then it's just what's defined is the velocity associated with the dpdk. But if the thing is in a region where it looks parabolic, then wave vector mass. It's a little bit like when we looked at the nearly free electron model. There's an effective mass that you can associate with the bottom band. There's an effective mass that you can associate with the states just above or below a gap. And those are different. Okay, that works in a picture where you have an excitation energy that goes quadratically in wave action. So the conductivity for a uniform field, electric field, in the Drude model is something like this, omega p squared over So this is the density of electrons, charge, the effective mass. If omega equals zero, it's the DC conductivity. It goes like n e squared tall over m squared.
Yeah.
I put a little label on it which says which is TR for transport. Okay, and that's exactly what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the difference between this tall and this one. Okay. Yeah.
Why is it k equals zero?
Well, that's the conductivity for a uniform external field. External electric field will drive a uniform electrical current.
So it's the mean.
It's the
saying that the direct velocity is zero.
No. This is the response to the current response to electric field.
Oh well, okay.
So if this is uniform, if this is uniform, this is uniform. This is the sigma of k equals zero. It's the coefficient that relates to the current response to a uniform field. That's all.
Okay.
So the question is, what's this? Okay. This thing here, as I said, the lifetime for an electron has to do with, for instance, you add an electron to the system in state k. What's the probability that you can pull it out later from the same state? Okay, that will decay if it has a finite lifetime. And so it's, if you like, if you think in terms of Green's functions, it's the one particle Green's function, adding one here, pulling it out later. Okay, so it's the basically the lifetime or the energy width associated with that quasi particle state. This here is the lifetime if you set up an electric current and then say, how does it decay? Okay, because in a metal, if there's resistance, it will stop, it will decay. Okay, so this transport lifetime is the relaxation current. And the current, if you like, you can write something like this. Where VK So the question that you have to ask yourself is, if you have a current, how does it relax or decay due to microscopic processes? Okay, I think I can do this fairly succinctly. here's one way, due to impurities. If you have an impurity here, electron can come in state K, go off in state K prime. And the important thing to recognize is that 1 over tau transport, the contribution from this process, goes like 1 minus these are unit vectors along k and k prime. What's the point here? The point is that if the impurity predominantly scatters and doesn't change the direction of the wave vector, then it doesn't change the current. But if it does change the direction of the wave vector, then it does change the current. The electrons moving along in a current will be randomized and scattered all over the place. And the current, if there is some current, will disappear. Electron-electron interactions. Say you have electron comes in with K, another one comes in with Q. They exchange some momentum, and this goes out with K minus Q. And this goes out with K plus, or Q plus Q. What does that do to the current? Anybody? What does it do to the current? Each one of these guys is carrying a charge. Okay. The answer is it doesn't actually do anything because momentum is conserved in these collisions. And so the electron-electron interactions actually don't change the electrical current, which just counts the number of charges times their velocities. Okay, so that doesn't do anything. On the other hand, you can have something called Umlaut. You can have the momentum changing by a reciprocal lattice vector. We talked about that, I mumbled about that briefly when we were doing Hartree-Fock, that this some of these two things might, this might have plus a reciprocal lattice vector in it. And in that case, because of the presence of a lattice and it's scattering through reciprocal lattice vectors, you get 1 over tau transport goes like t squared times the probability of this Umlaut process. But otherwise, usually I would say, and I'll try to finish up. We're not going to talk about phonons, but this gives 1 over tau transport goes like T. And T to the fifth is the Debye frequency by temperature, I guess you could call it. It's basically the characteristic phonon energy. So most of the time you're looking at phonons unless you're looking at impurities, and you hardly ever see electron-electron interactions in normal metals. That's the point. And I just want to just mention one example. Thank you. where the transport lifetime is much, much longer than the electronic lifetime. And that's in these semiconductor or gallium arsenide heterostructures. Where they make a material where you have electrons trapped in an interface, which is extremely perfect, and the electrons come from donor ions which are set way back from the interface. Okay? And because of the fact that this, these randomly positioned donor ions, their potential up here basically decays like if you Fourier transform it, it goes like either minus QZ. There's, you get largely forward scattering amongst these, of these electrons by the impurity potential. So what happens basically is that the transport lifetime is extremely long, even though the electronic lifetime, in other words, the lifetime of each electronic state, is constantly interrupted by moving through this random potential, by being scattered by very small amounts. Okay, so that's a sort of an interesting and extreme case of this different transport. Okay, so that's it. Tomorrow we'll start on supercomputing.
No, that
can you buy?